This is a podcast from RTE Radio.
Hello, and you're welcome to The Quantum Leap. Coming up, a vast lake that lies hidden deep under the Antarctic ice sheet, web television in Navan in County Meath, and the current plight of the corncrake in Ireland. But first, to bioinformatics. Now, that's the interface between biology and computing. Some people also call it computational biology. And in the future, it could lead to new drugs and devices that are tailored to a person's genetic makeup. Well, to keep Ireland at the leading edge of this new field, a new Institute of Biomedical Informatics has just been set up. It's a €30 million joint collaboration between the Irish government and Hewlett-Packard, and it involves NUI Galway, University College Dublin, Trinity College Dublin, and Queen's University in Belfast, and it's going to conduct research and development in biomedical informatics. Well, to tell me more about this, I'm joined now from our Galway studio by Dr. Eamon O'Toole of Hewlett-Packard and Professor Terry Smith for National University of Ireland in Galway. Eamon O'Toole, can I start with you? Just what is biomedical informatics?
Well, quite simply, biomedical informatics is the application of information technology to medicine. And in your introduction, you mentioned a couple of things, bioinformatics and computational biology, and they are part of biomedical informatics. It spans everything from fundamental research in molecular biology and how information technology is applied to that, all the way through to hospital systems and information management in hospitals, and all points in between.
Okay. Professor Terry Smith, as one of the researchers, can I bring you into this and ask you to give me some concrete examples of the kind of research that might be done?
Okay. Well, Mary, as Eamon has outlined, the Biomedical Informatics Institute, the programme of research, will involve linking biology with computational analysis from basic research right through to patient information, patient images. So, for example, we're looking at, in some of our programs, we will be looking at the genetic information in individuals and relating that to susceptibility to disease and response to different drug treatments. So the computational analysis is a critical part of this, where we can analyse the actual genetic code of individuals and use very large computer systems and programs to get information across a wide range of individuals and genetic information.
And it might be, just to understand myself, somebody with a particular form of arthritis, and you might get different people who respond well to a drug and other people who don't, and that might be a genetic difference, and you'll be able to study that. Is it that kind
exactly
of thing?
That's exactly it. And I suppose another example could come from the cancer area, and again, part of the programme in this new institute will be in the area of cancer, where different individuals who are given the same treatment for a particular cancer, some may respond very well to the drug, some may not respond, some in fact may respond badly and have an adverse reaction to the drug. So it's very important to understand the genetic makeup of individuals so that the correct and personalised drug treatments can be given to these individuals.
It sounds like the future of medicine. Eamon O'Toole, what is the role for Hewlett-Packard in this?
The reason that HP is involved in this, I suppose it's there's a bit of history here. So we've had a fairly successful track record in the application of information technology to biology over the years. Going back to the genome sequencing efforts of the 90s and beyond. And essentially, the reason that we're involved in biomedical informatics and in this institute is so that we can understand the needs of scientists such as Terry and his team in Galway and the teams in UCD and Trinity College and in Queen's, their scientific needs and how that translates into information technology needs. And then leading on from that, HP as a company must have been in the position to sell services and products based on that knowledge to industry.
So it could be a win-win situation there for the company and the researchers. Terry Smith, this is a big collaboration involving a big corporation and four campuses. Is this the future of research in Ireland?
Well, it's certainly a very important new aspect to university research. Over the last 5-6 years, the university sector in Ireland has become much more responsive to industry and aware of the need for their research to be industry relevant and, you could say, validated by industry. Essentially, rather than simply carrying out fundamental blue skies research, which is obviously a key part of university life, it's also recognised now within the university sector that our research needs to be converted into clinical application and or commercial products. So to show the value of the research and essentially to repay the funding agencies and ultimately the taxpayer for the investment in research within the university sector, we're much more conscious now and developing much a greater number of industry collaborations to ensure that the results of the research going on in Irish universities is translated into either improved patient care or technologies that can be used to advantage and to improve our economic situation.
Very good. Well, I'm sure the taxpayer who's listening will be pleased to hear that. That's the Institute of Biomedical Informatics. Is there a website for the Institute?
Not yet. It'll be on the way very, very soon.
OK, one to watch out for. My thanks to Dr. Eamon O'Toole of Hewlett-Packard and Professor Terry Smith from NUI Galway. Now, traditionally, you would have listened to this radio programme on, well, on the radio. But in the last couple of years, radio has exploded onto the World Wide Web with a bang. And these days, you can listen to radio programmes streaming over the internet and as podcasts and on your MP3 player. Well, now television looks set to hit the internet as well. And leading the charge is a community TV station in Navan in County Meath. It's called P5 TV. And our reporter, Terry Flanagan, went along to talk to station director Kevin McNamee.
Kevin McNamee, you're the station director of Ireland's latest TV station to go on air. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, P5 TV went on air on the 7th of December 2006, so we're on air a couple of weeks only. However, we have been on air 15 years by ministerial order. The present licence has been given to us by the BCI. And it's a community station run for the community, by the community.
Now, we're here in your broadcast studios in Navan, and the station is playing away here in the background. Tell us a little bit about the room where we are here now.
Well, this is probably the post-production and transmission. Our station can only be seen on cable, on the Chorus cable in Navan and its environs. And there are about 5,000 houses connected to the station 24/7. So our programmes go out every 3 hours from midnight, so they're repeated. But one of the things we needed to do was to improve the viewership. And on the 7th, we also went on the World Wide Web. So people all over the world can see our programmes on demand, not the way we broadcast them, but on demand anytime during the day. And you'll find that when you go into our website, you'll be able to see the programmes, and you'll also see all the archives of programmes that we have broadcast today.
So on the top right hand corner of your web page there, I see here, click here for web TV. So you can actually look at a different program here anywhere across the world to what's being broadcast live in Navan.
Yes, this is our new way of communicating to more than 5,000 people. By clicking on this web TV, you can actually go into our archives, and now you see a screen in front of you, and down at the bottom of the screen there are different titles of programmes which we've already made, and you can actually look at the archives or look at the latest ones, which are always at the top of the screen.
Okay, well, I see there, for instance, Outside the Frame.
Yeah, this is made in Navan, and it's made on a weekly basis, and it's one of our community programmes. It's made by the people, and we have actually done some training with young people, and this is their programme. It's a programme for under 35s.
I must say, it's the quality is excellent on it too.
Yeah, it's quite good actually, and the pictures of Hector there, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, they're it's not a full screen, but it's very clear, I think.
And of course, Hector is a local man.
It's one of the local men. Yes, we have Tommy Tiernan and a whole lot of other celebrities as such.
And they're involved, are they, in any
yes.
way with P5 TV?
They're all involved. No, not directly. But in fact, when we were talking to Hector, Hector knew about us. I mean, he's been here. He knew about us years ago, but not as the way we're broadcasting at the moment.
Now, how important is broadcasting on the World Wide Web to you?
Well, you know, when we look at the cable company Corus, for instance, we're not sure who's watching us at home. First of all, because we are repeating ourselves every 3 hours, so people could watch us in the middle of the night or in the middle of the morning or having their tea. However, on the World Wide Web, I can actually see statistics on who has been watching us.
So here on this screen here, Kevin, I can actually see from where people are viewing your station from all over the world.
That's correct, yes. And this is something that we have. It's innovative to P5 TV. So just looking at this, the top 10 at the moment is Ireland.
Yeah, 37% of people watching at the moment are viewing from Ireland.
That's correct. United States.
17.95%.
United Kingdom.
Yeah, 6.5%.
China.
China, there's 4.6%. Canada, 3.76%. Hungary, 2%, and so on. And they're all the people who are watching at the moment. Have they viewed before? Can you tell whether they've viewed before or
yes,
this is their
can.
First time?
We can. In another part of this programme, we can actually see how many times they've viewed.
And can you tell them what programmes they're actually watching?
Because
yes. they can pick whatever programme from the archive that they want to see.
Yes, we know what programme they have actually watched when they're finished.
This can help you then, for instance, for making future programmes. There's a lot of statistics here.
Plenty of statistics.
Like market research.
Absolutely, and this is a great way of doing it. For instance, in this particular column, you can see what's happened over the last 24 hours. You can actually see what's happened over the last week and the last month, and that's our stats to date.
So what you're looking at on this particular set of graphs here are the number of people that have viewed in the past week and in the past year, how many per day.
And what time during the day.
What they're also looking at as well.
Mm.
Where do you see the trend then for the future?
I really do believe that the trend for P5 television is going to be on the web.
And would that be the case for a lot of TV stations?
It probably will. More people are watching or are spending time on their computer and using their computer than they are watching television. And for us, I mean, we could never ever broadcast worldwide. I mean, we wouldn't have the resources. I mean, we're a voluntary organisation. But here we are broadcasting worldwide. Pictures and programs that we make here and now.
And because you can actually see what people are viewing, what type of program they're viewing, that could help you in producing different programs in the future.
It is, yes, it's part of our, that'll be our market research as well as everything else.
And what trends have you seen in the short time that you've been on air?
Well, a lot of people have been watching stuff that we have produced last year prior to going on air for the second time. And a lot of people are actually watching the present local programme. So people are watching. It's just far too early. We're only a couple of weeks up and running in this new process.
And what do you see the trends for the future?
I do believe that community television will grow. Hopefully before May or the end of May, we'll have Dublin, a community station in Dublin, which will be on the NTL network, probably on a digital channel. And I'd say before the end of the year, Cork will be on air. As well, also on the Corus. Of course, Corus and NTL have been bought over, so it's got to be on a new channel, a new name channel.
And can you see community television rivaling national television like RTE?
Probably not, but it's like community radio. People will listen and watch stuff that is local at certain times to keep up with the news that's happening in and around the community.
Because it is a niche market.
It is a niche market. But look, they're watching also all over the world.
Terry Flanagan reporting there from P5 TV in Navan in County Meath. You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. Still to come, the plight of the corncrake in Ireland. But before we visit the Shannon Callows, we're heading to Antarctica because we want to hear about a vast lake that has lain hidden deep beneath the ice sheet for 15 million years. And over the coming year, scientists expect to drill into the lake. And who knows what they'll uncover there, a sterile environment perhaps, or new and exotic life forms. Well, joining me on the line from London is science writer Gabriel Walker, who's recently spent time in Antarctica. Gabriel, hi there.
Hello.
Can you take us to Antarctica, first of all? What's it like there?
It is the most fabulous place on earth, if you ask me. It's amazingly bleak. It's not for everybody because it's very bleak. It's white, it's cold, it's high, it's dry. It's actually drier than the Sahara in the middle of Antarctica. And around the edges, it's very beautiful. You have kind of seals and penguins and glaciers and stuff. But in the middle, there really is nothing but white ice and sunshine in the summer and white ice and dark nights that last a month in the winter.
Now, you're describing a place that's dry and frozen, and I think of it as a wasteland. So it must have come as something of a surprise when scientists discovered this enormous lake they call Lake Vostok back in the 1990s, because I gather it has as much water as Lake Michigan in North America. How did they discover this lake when it's buried 4 kilometres under the ice?
There's no way that they hadn't actually drilled into it. They didn't know that it was there. But what they did find out was that there was a patch of the surface which was unusually flat. And normally the ice in Antarctica is actually quite bumpy, and that reflects the kind of bumpiness of the ground deep, deep beneath. But in this case, it was very, very flat, and they decided that it must be floating on top of something. And so they started trying to work out how big this lake was, and they fired down seismic waves. They made little explosions on the surface and fired down seismic waves. And more or less everywhere they looked, there was water. It was amazing to see how big this lake was.
What do we know about the lake environment? Indeed, can we know anything until we actually break into it? I mean, for instance, can we know, is there oxygen in the water?
Well, we can imagine that there is, because there is another extraordinary thing about this lake. Researchers have actually drilled down almost all the way to it because they were looking for something else. They were drilling out pieces of ice core to try and tell them about what the climate had been like in the past. And while they were doing that, they suddenly noticed that the ice had looked very different. Instead of it looking like normal Antarctic ice, it started to look like stuff that had come recently from water. And what they discovered is parts of the lake were actually freezing back onto the underside of the ice. So they've actually pulled up some pieces of the lake and looked at it and sort of looked what's in it. And there's a big controversy at the moment. Some people have said that they found bugs in it. Some people have said that they found bits of dirt or other chemicals. Other people have said, no, that's contamination. But the first sign seems to be that it's obviously completely isolated. It's very dark down there. But it looks still as if there may be at least some bacteria, some other kinds of life that have made it up into the ice above it.
It's intriguing. When do they expect to actually drill into the lake and reach the water that's there?
Well, that's actually quite a controversial topic, because the Russians are determined to drill in this next season, which will be this kind of Christmas coming up. But the trouble is they will drill through the hole that's already been drilled, and that's actually full of kerosene and other kind of junks that they had to use to do the drilling in the first place. And many people are worried that might actually contaminate the lake and spoil what's down there. The Russians are sure that it won't. Other people are a bit worried about it. But if the Russians don't do it this season, there aren't any other plans for a separate hole, and so it's a kind of all or nothing question.
Now, since scientists discovered Lake Vostok in about the mid-1990s, they've gone on to discover, I think, is it nearly 150 other lakes in Antarctica? So does this mean our understanding of the frozen continent is changing with all this new information?
It's completely transformed it, because, you know, Antarctica has always been thought of as being cold and dry, and it moves very, very slowly, it moves glacially. But in fact, what's happening on the underside is very, very different. It's not just that there's lakes, there's also there's marshes and swamps, there's even waterfalls that seem to flow uphill, and all sorts of strange and wacky things down there. And so, you know, you can almost say that it's the hidden face of Antarctica. The water is the hidden face of Antarctica, and, you know, like with most of us, the hidden face is probably the most important one.
Oh, gosh, and I presume if we discover life in the lake, it might tell us something about life on other planets. Gabriel, I gather you've just recently published a book. Is it about Antarctica?
This one isn't about Antarctica, but it's about another of my favourite subjects, which is the atmosphere. I got interested in that because of the ice core in Antarctica that traps little tiny bubbles of air from really ancient times. But I started to discover all sorts of other amazing things about the air. It turns out that it's heavier than you'd think. It's more powerful than you'd think. We think it's very fragile, but in fact, it's amazingly strong. It's as tough as old boots. It squashes down and it's so heavy that you'd think we ought to be crushed. And in fact, all the people that discovered that, people right the way through from the 17th century who've come up with all sorts of amazing things about something that I once thought was ordinary. It isn't. It's magic.
And that most important piece of information, Gabriel, what's the book called?
It's called An Ocean of Air, and it's out now.
An Ocean of Air. Gabriel Walker in London, thank you very much indeed. Well, that's the very distinctive call of the corncrake, announcing the fact that it's time for our weekly look at the natural world. And as spring is in the air, we're turning our attention to bird life and the arrival of summer migrants, and in particular, the corncrake. Well, joining me on the line now is Alec Copeland from Birdwatch Ireland. He's a senior conservation officer there, and he's currently managing their corncrake project. Alec, can I ask you, have the corncrakes arrived yet?
They haven't. We're hoping for them any day now. Normally they would be arriving. We usually have an average date of around about the 20th, the 21st of April. Occasionally we get an early one in, but nothing yet.
Okay. What's the current status of the corncrake in Ireland?
The population in Ireland has been stable for a few years, thanks largely to the sort of conservation efforts that we have in the various areas where they occur. Unfortunately, fortunately, in the birds that we have in, say, the north and the west, on the Donegal coast, on the Connacht coast, Mayo and Connemara, the numbers are increasing. The problem that we have is in the Shannon Callows in the centre of Ireland. There's been a couple of summers of very severe summer flooding, and that has really disrupted the breeding of the corncrakes there, and the numbers there have declined.
How many are we talking about, Alec?
In Ireland in total, we're looking at around 160 calling males. It's only the calling males that we count, because the birds are very secretive. We very rarely, if ever, see them. So we count them by counting the calling males. So we're talking about 160 calling males in the whole of Ireland.
It doesn't sound like many. What is Birdwatch Ireland doing to protect them?
Well, we've been running a corncrake conservation project now for the last, this will be coming into its 15th or 16th year. And by doing, the corncrakes require tall vegetation in which to nest and to rear their chicks. So it's basically creating that and protecting that habitat for them during the breeding season. Now, hay meadows are absolutely perfect habitats for them, and that's where they tend to occur. So what we do where the corncrakes occur and where there is hay meadow, we offer farmers an incentive to delay the mowing of those hay meadows until August or even to September to allow the corncrake to breed successfully in sort of peace and quiet. And we also pay farmers another incentive to cut in a corncrake-friendly manner. And also we do some work on creating new habitats for them early in the year and also, again, later in the year as well, at the end of the breeding season.
If these birds are very secretive and you don't see them, how can you tell one male from the other? Do they all sound differently?
No. Well, they probably do if we were using sort of decent sonic equipment.
Or if you were a female corncrake, I suppose.
I don't know if they're particularly choosy or not. I assume that they are, but one corncrake to me sounds very much like the next. Corncrakes have a wonderful habit of when the male finds a nocturnal calling position where he'll stand and call all night, he's looking for good acoustics where his voice is going to carry a long way to try and attract females from as far away as possible. And once he's found that spot, he doesn't tend to move from it very much. So therefore, we can go out and the bird will quite often, in some cases, you'll have a bird that doesn't move more than a few feet from the calling site for the entire summer. And therefore, we can go out in several nights and map where the corncrakes occur. And from doing that, we end up with a reasonably good idea of the number of corncrakes that we have.
Sounds like they're very territorial. Yeah. In terms of research on them, what have you been doing?
Well, we're just coming to the end of, we've been doing a research project in collaboration with University College Cork and the National Parks and Wildlife Service in the Department of the Environment, which has been looking at the corncrake use specifically in the Shannon Callows, where they're under the most threat. And we've been looking at what kind of habitats they're using, how they react to the farmers when they go on to mow the meadows. And we've been doing that by catching corncrakes and fitting them with very, very, very small radio transmitters. And then we have the receivers in, the field workers go out with receivers and they can track the corncrakes, they can track their movements, they can see the habitats that they're using, they can see where the birds are moving around, they can see how the birds are even responding to machinery when it's actually in the field.
Okay.
And from that information we can then develop and devise sort of good new management techniques in order to preserve the corncrakes.
Very good. And finally, if people hear a corncrake calling, do you want them to get in touch with you and give them a notice?
Definitely. We'd very much welcome anybody who hears a corncrake calling. The phone number here in the office is 057915 1676. Or alternatively, anyone can log on to the Birdwatch Ireland website, which is www.birdwatchireland.ie. And there'll be information there on the corncrakes and also who to get in touch with and how to get in touch with us if somebody hears a corncrake.
Perfect. And we'll repeat that information on our own programme website. Alec Copeland of Birdwatch Ireland, thank you very much.
Thank you. And-
Just trying to tell you that some UCD paleontologists whom we featured on the programme before Easter are heading to Morocco later this month for a special fossil hunting expedition. They're going in search of dinosaurs in the Sahara. Nice work if you can get it. Well, that's it for this week. You'll find more information about the items in this week's programme on our programme website, as always. That's at rte.ie/radio1/quantum. And if you'd like to contact the programme, drop us an email to quantum@rte.ie. But for me, Mary Mulvihill, until next week, Slán tamall.